Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I'm very pleased to have with us a man who has served with great distinction in a variety of capacities in various phases of this war for the free world. His name is Colonel Grant Newsom, United States Marine Corps retired. In addition to having served his country with distinction in the uniform of a U.S. Marine, he has also been a foreign service officer. He has also been involved in international business, particularly in the Asian theater. He has been associated with, I'm very proud to say, of late, the Center for Security Policy as a senior fellow. He is also a research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies, and a great resource. We're always delighted to have him with us. Grant Newsom, thanks for joining us today.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks very much.
I have so much to talk with you about. I hardly know where to begin, but let me start with Afghanistan. It's top of mind for a lot of us, especially as we're witnessing this, catastrophe, really, unfold. Talk a little bit about it from the perspective, Grant, if you would, of not only somebody who has been intimately involved with military affairs for most of your professional life, what this means for Afghanistan itself and our vital security concerns there, as well as for the region.
It's a disaster. We always have to start with that. And it's if you were to put it on a scale, say 1 to 10, with 10 being the worst, this is about a 20. In terms of what's going to happen to Afghanistan, it's obviously come under the control of a just ruthless, murderous gang of religious fundamentalists. And, well, that's what it is. And unfortunately, this is sort of on the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, this is a thoroughgoing defeat of the United States. So Afghanistan has been left to the tender mercies of these people, and many people who were counting on us, people who helped us, many people who just wanted to have the stability that that Afghanistan had for sort of some years and did not want the Taliban to come back. Well, they're left to the Taliban's control now. So this is just a humanitarian catastrophe of the worst order, and it's going to happen to people who thought they could count on the United States. China, of course, is already making hay of what's happened, and they'll be insinuating themselves into Afghanistan, particularly to get the minerals. And they will also, they'll have good enough relations with the Taliban, partly because China's been supporting them with weapons and money since the 1990s and throughout the war when we were there. And they will have this nice access all the way to Iran, where China's new best friends, the Iranians, are. So it looks pretty good from a geopolitical standpoint for the Chinese at the moment. And this is, it's really is something of global importance. It's not just this localized setback for the United States, but this is something that will have ripple effects felt in all corners of the world.
I want to pick up on that point with respect particularly to China and the Pacific, but before I do, just a further thought on Afghanistan. In addition to the humanitarian crisis there and the abandonment of allies such as we've had in the country and the implications of all of that for our interests in Afghanistan and its immediate surroundings, we also have the problem that such people as we are pulling out of there, Afghans that we have been told are special visa applicants that are interpreters or others who have served our country. It turns out, according to one report I've seen, that 100 out of 7,000 Afghans who've been processed in Qatar have actually been identified by our intelligence agencies as people on watch lists. Grant, talk just a little bit about what it implies if we are going to have people who are brought into our country, put on military installations, at least initially, who may well be of the jihadist stripe themselves.
Well, it inserts people who want to kill us and do commit acts, if you think of the 9/11 attacks and the subsequent terrorist attack in the United States around the, and in Europe in particular, you've suddenly let them into the U.S. You've given them access. And the Taliban, these aren't just Taliban, these aren't really Taliban, actually. These are the committed terrorists. And they, that's what they think about. That's, they go about their daily life thinking about how they can hurt America, hurt the Western world, the Christians, etc. And that's what they do. So this, for them, this was a, an opportunity to get into the United, get some people into the United States. And it's good that our people are on the ball enough to have spotted this. It would be nice if they would take them off the planes and put them somewhere else. But that is
Gitmo comes to mind, but they're in the process of closing that too, as I understand it.
Yeah.
And but just to put this in perspective, Grant, you know, let's say it's 100, and maybe that's the full extent of it. I think it's unlikely, but 19 hijackers, lest we forget, 20 years ago, did incalculable damage to this country and cost us. Well, trillions, for sure. And the likelihood that that will be the agenda of at least some of those folks migrating into this country, perhaps unvetted, perhaps inadequately vetted at least, is a very real concern. Let me switch again quickly, if I can, because we've got more to talk about than we've got time with you, Grant Newsom, to China's ambitions in the Far East and whether they will be emboldened not only in Afghanistan, and with respect to their efforts to dominate Central Asia and, you know, other parts of the Euro-Asian landmass, but specifically that they will be pursuing much more aggressively, even than they have of late, perhaps even kinetically, as they say, their determination to force the acquisition of Taiwan.
Yes, the Chinese objective is to dominate Asia. It's to drive the Americans out of the region and to have China be the country that calls the shots and everybody quake before them. And Afghanistan has given them a psychological boost. And there's a, they smell weakness. They smell confusion on the part of the Americans. So this encourages them. It gives them more motivation than they are, and they already had plenty of that to start with. So there's a sense that the Americans are on, not just on the back foot or on the mat. And you will see the Chinese continuing their already impressive military buildup that can give the Americans trouble even now, and a lot of trouble. And their political warfare campaign is continuing that has psychological, political, economic components to it. And they feel that they've got the wind in their sails. And they are going to get more aggressive against us, but particularly against our friends, and will present us with a situation, I think, before too long, where they tell the Americans, stand clear, unless you want nuclear war. And the Americans just might back off. So this is as dangerous a time as it has been in my lifetime.
Grant, you are, among other things, a valued member of the Committee on the Present Danger, China, and one of our other colleagues in that committee, Jim Fennell, was on the program yesterday, and we talked a bit about the steps that the Chinese have taken to establish a vast maritime lift capacity to help enable an invasion of Taiwan, should it come to that. It wouldn't be the only element, of course, but the question is this in place now, and is it operational in a way that would enable, perhaps from a standing start, such an effort to be mounted, leaving us with very little, if any, warning. And I was struck by a report that I saw recently about a cargo ship being used by the Chinese in a recent exercise for troop transport purposes. Again, a demonstration of a capability that could be quite ominous in this context. Your thoughts on all of that?
Well, they've had the capability for at least the last 10 years. It's just now that it's getting the recognition that it deserves, and they've improved it in the last decade. And what you're talking about, of course, is incorporating civilian ships, civilian transport into an invasion or an attack plan against Taiwan. And that has been part of Chinese operational doctrine for a long, long time, for decades. But they've really have, to their credit, have just gotten better and better at it. So what they can use are, say, ferries, amphibious ships, the roll-on vessels, and can incorporate those into their military, and it exponentially increases your resources, the combat power you need. And they're good at it, and they're just getting better and better at it.
If they have now got a capacity in all of these areas, and by the way, missiles aimed at Taiwan among their kit, to go with very little, if any, advanced notice to us, indicators and warnings, as they call it in the business. Would you say that the Chinese may feel so bold by what they've been witnessing of late? And not least, let's be clear, the deep compromise of so many people from the president on down in senior positions of the U.S. government, that they would actually take the step of launching an invasion without having done sort of a dress rehearsal to assure all of this really works out? Would they risk everything on a pretty hard target without some further preparation of that kind, in your estimation, Grant Newsom?
Yeah, well, I think they are capable of an assault from a standing start. Now, that's people argue that point, but I think they can. I wouldn't underestimate them on this score. I think the Chinese would, of course, prefer to get Taiwan without a fight, and you could see them issuing an ultimatum to the United States, to Taiwan, once again, saying, stand clear. And as you pointed out, it's a question of will, and whether or not a U.S. administration would actually risk nuclear war over Taiwan. It, unfortunately, over the last 10 days or so, I think there's more doubts that have been raised than in a good long while. So there's several aspects to it. And once again, China would like to get Taiwan the easy way, but they are ready. And I think one, can assume they are so willing to fight to get it.
Without doing a dress rehearsal on, perhaps outer islands of Taiwan that are close by the Chinese shore?
Yes. Well, there's a menu of options. And one of them is, of course, to get one of the little islands that right off of Taiwan, that are right off the Chinese mainland, maybe get an island in the middle of the Taiwan Strait, and do that first and intimidate the Taiwanese and us and everyone else, or they could just go all out on the mainland. So it's like a football game where a coach has a number of plays he can call, and he may not know exactly which one he's going to do, but he's prepared for all of those.
And that's what we have to be equally prepared to address as well. Let me turn to the question of whether or not, in the Chinese eyes, the appearance in the region of Kamala Harris, the Vice President of the United States, has in any way affected their calculations, their sense of the window of opportunity, their correlation of forces, if you will. She talked about China in what was billed as a great Indo-Pac vision speech. And among other things, she called for China to cease its behavior that is inconsistent with, as she put it, I think, the rules-based order. I'm not quite sure what to make of that as a turn of phrase, but what do you think the Chinese are making of it? And more to the point, what credibility she brings to all of this?
I would say the Chinese are sort of thinking, is that all you got? If you're just going to come and tell us we're bad guys, and that you're committed to Asia, if that's all you're going to say, well, okay, that's fine. The Chinese Navy still can outnumber the Americans in the South China Sea by at least 10 ships to one. America doesn't have a shipbuilding plan to rebuild its Navy. It's effectively cutting its defense spending. Its priorities are inward and financially irresponsible. So the vice president can go there and say, America's back, America's committed. But I don't really think anyone in the region believes her all that much. And I'm not saying this with any...
Those are our friends.
As Americans, we want every administration to succeed. We want the country to succeed. But this, I would have to say, is simply not convincing. It is not going to convince the Chinese, and it is not going to convince our allies, our partners down there. They hope for the best, and they hope America might wake up and sort of get off the mat. But I think they've got some doubts, and it's up to the U.S. government, this administration, to collect itself and get its wits together and convince people that America is indeed going to defend itself and the concept of human freedom.
Yeah, amen. I was struck by a tell in that regard. I'm told that the Vietnamese with whom Kamala Harris has been meeting, of course, the day-to-day, have indicated that they don't think this is the time to, quote, poke the dragon, unquote. And if this isn't the time, it's almost certainly the case that there will be less and less attractive times to come, and less and less capability, perhaps, on the part of the rest of us to not simply provoke the Chinese, but actively oppose what they're doing, again, at the expense of freedom throughout that region. Not that there's a whole lot of it in Vietnam, let me be clear, but there is some still elsewhere, and we mustn't let it become further endangered. Lastly, speaking of which, Grant Newsom, you've spent a lot of time focused on South Korea and the policies of the Moon Jae-in regime there that are increasingly aligning that government with North Korea on the one hand and China on the other. Talk a little bit about where that stands at the moment and evidence that there are very aggressive influence operations being mounted in our own country to try to shape our perceptions of what's going on in a way that could be quite detrimental to our position in that country, South Korea, that is, and in East Asia more generally.
Yes. Well, regarding South Korea, and it doesn't get the attention it deserves, but what you have is a extreme leftist radical administration in South Korea, the Moon Jae-in administration. These are guys who've been radicals for 40 years at least, and their objective is to get the Americans off the peninsula, to somehow unify the Korean peninsula, and under really one-party rule, which is Moon's party, to align South Korea with China. And this, they've been clear about this and what they've said. And yet what you hear so always from officialdom in America and the academic class and commentariat is rock solid relationship. The U.S.-Iraq alliance has never been stronger. But if you give it just some rudimentary examination, even you'll see that it is troubled. It is potentially collapsible. And that deserves to, we really need to plan for that and do something about it, because fortunately in South Korea, most people don't want to end the alliance. But we have seen before what a committed group of radicals who somehow find themselves, say, in the local equivalent of the White House, how they can actually move a country where most people don't want to go. And unfortunately, there has been a sort of an unwillingness on the part of people who should know better on the U.S. side to recognize the Moon regime and South Korean leftists for what they are, and to really to bolster the people who see things differently there. And they, South Koreans have done a very good job, actually, of buying off many of the think tanks and the so-called commentariat and even the political class in Washington, D.C.
This is a subject to which we will return both with you, Grant Newsom, and our colleague Lawrence Peck, who has been making a concerted effort to study and expose these kinds of influence operations. They are very detrimental, I think, to our security interests. Desperately need more attention, as you say. Thank you for your attention to all of these matters and for sharing it with us so generously. We appreciate what you do, both for the Center for Security Policy and at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies. I know you'll keep it up and look forward to having you back soon. Next up, we will speak with David Wormser. We'll talk about other aspects of the collateral damage from Afghanistan in the Middle East. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. My beloved boss Ronald Reagan repeatedly warned that, quote, every generation faces an existential threat to freedom, unquote, adding that it had to be fought for and defended and passed on to the next generation to do the same. With each passing day, it becomes clearer that we are now beset by the existential threat to liberty of our time. For example, we are being subjected to an unmitigated disaster in Afghanistan that is emboldening jihadists and other enemies and alienating our friends. The arrival of millions of illegal aliens, some of whom are ill with COVID and or other diseases, all of whom are unvetted. The institution of vaccine mandates and passports highly susceptible to Chinese-style government abuse, and legislation that would foreclose future free and fair elections. Will we defend freedom or ignominiously bequeath to the next generation a formerly free America? This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome back to our next guest. He is Dr. David Wormser. He's a dear friend and very valued colleague at the Center for Security Policy, where he is our senior fellow and the director of the Project on Global Anti-Semitism and the U.S.-Israel Relationship, part of our new Middle East and North Africa program at the center. David is an accomplished national security practitioner, served for 11 years in the United States Navy as an intelligence officer, rising to the rank of lieutenant commander. He's also been an advisor to then Vice President Dick Cheney and former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton. David, it's so good to have you with us. Welcome, and I appreciate you finding a few minutes for us in a difficult day.
Thank you, Frank. It's a great pleasure to be here.
I want to talk with you, David, about sort of the Middle East post the Afghan meltdown, or as I call it, the Biden bug out. One aspect of which, of course, is the Iranian piece. The Iranian regime seems to have been very keen, despite the differences between Sunnis and Shia, to maintain and build on their relationship with the mullahs now running, with the Taliban. And I just wonder what your take is on whether this will result in any change on the part of the Biden administration in terms of its desperate bid to appease and engage the mullahs of Iran.
Well, first of all, I think you mentioned something very important, which is here in the West, we live by this idea that Sunnis and Shiites will never cooperate. Secular Arab nationalists and religious Islamists will never cooperate. Jihadis will never cooperate. When it comes to the United States and those ideologies that are so deeply opposed to the United States, whether it's the secular form of Baathism, Arab nationalism, or it's Iranian Shiite revolution, or it's Al-Qaeda and the Sunni Islamist jihadis, they see, all of them, that the United States and Israel is the little part of the United States in their view. They see the West as their primary enemy in the long run. They still look at it in terms of the global conquest of the world, of Islam, and we are the biggest force that stands in their way. So when it comes to us, you will see cooperation between those forces. You saw those in Afghanistan. The Iranians didn't play a minor role over the years to help expel us, to hurt us, to bleed us, to wear us down. And even though it was the Taliban, which in the end of days would be their biggest enemy, in the end of days, that's the future. So right now they cooperate, and you'll see that across the board with attacks on us and so forth. Unfortunately, in response to this assault on us and the collapse of Afghanistan and the collapse of any semblance of American power that emanated from Afghanistan, what you'll see is in the West, a retreat to this idea of, well, now we have two or three problem nations, and you'll see this idea to work with one to contain the other. So as we discover that the Taliban are still the same Taliban that hosted bin Laden and have the same ideology of murderous destruction of the West, and we see the fallout from that, whether it's refugees fleeing to Europe, some of which are planted terrorists, or heavily armed terrorists spreading throughout the Middle East, you'll see the temptation in the Biden administration to try to contain the fallout of Afghanistan. And then they will seek to do that. They will seek the cooperation of Iran, which exacerbates the problem. And that's, of course, one of the reasons why Iran was helping all this chaos and driving so much of this chaos, because it knows the West will turn to it then to control the chaos. So if there's a change with the Biden administration, unfortunately, I'm afraid it may be to seek yet greater accommodation with Iran.
David, a few weeks ago, there was a report out of and I can't remember where, IAEA maybe, or other monitors of what's going on in Iran, that the enrichment of uranium using advanced centrifuges had reached a point where the mullahs may be 10 weeks away from a breakout capability, that is to say, having some kind of nuclear bomb capacity. Well, that was several weeks ago. Is it possible to say with any precision as to whether we are now 7 weeks away, or perhaps less? And what are the implications of that for the kind of conduct that the Biden team is engaged in?
Well, I think in that context, we had those reports. We've also had reports of advanced work on uranium metal, which is, useful for bombs. My suspicion is obviously that the Iranians are that much closer by weeks than what was said a few weeks ago. So we're getting really, really close. The problem that we're going to have is, I think you see that the Israeli prime minister is flying to Washington to meet with Biden. And I think what you'll see is a serious problem emerging, which is we have politicized our intelligence by using our head of intelligence, Bill Byrne, as the chief negotiator for things. Bill Burns was in Israel a week or two ago to try to kickstart the peace process. Yesterday, he apparently was in Kabul trying to negotiate with Taliban some control of the chaos of our evacuation. I think to no success, but nevertheless, some control of the chaos. The issue is that the head of the CIA, Bill Burns, is being used in a political role as negotiator, which means that he is vested in the decisions that the administration makes and the policies that the administration is pursuing. And his intelligence structure will respond to his directives and what they perceive to be his desires, which means they will produce intelligence that supports his policy direction. And that on the Iranian issue will mean that they will generally begin to downplay or cast doubt on the accuracy of these various estimates that Iran is this close. So my fear is that our intelligence is going to become increasingly dysfunctional in knowing where we are with the Iranian program. In contrast, the Israelis, who are very focused on this program and see it as an existential threat, their intelligence is operating at full speed and intense focus on Iran. They have very good, very accurate, very deep penetration of Iranian nuclear activities. So I think what we'll see is this very tense situation where the Israelis are coming and saying, we are days and weeks away, we need to act. And our intelligence community saying, if only we get this deal, and we have evidence that they want that deal because the intelligence community will produce it, that we can buy this big conflict and potential strike or breakdown away. So all of a sudden, the United States and Israel are in diametric opposite places. The Israelis are telling the United States, we're now at payday. I mean, this is now payday. I mean, this is really the point at which you have to make a decision. If Iran's not going to get a bomb, you must act. The United States is sitting there now and saying, well, now we're getting to the point where we have to have a deal. And this means Israel. Yeah. So Israel and America are headed for a collision course. And in that context, the United States and its European allies, Biden and his European allies, will be more worried about Israeli wildcat action, more worried about Israeli independent activity to stop Iran than they will be about Iran itself, because it will compromise their ability to reach the deal that they want to reach. So I see, unfortunately, at the moment when we should be closing ranks with Israel and with the UAE and Saudis and others to finally and decisively bring to an end Iran's nuclear program, we are going to get into probably the worst fight with the Israelis over their nervousness.
David, this is such a vitally important analysis, and I appreciate particularly your emphasis on the politicization of the intelligence community of the United States. It is, I think, as you've said, assuredly the case that they will be pushing hard this narrative that we can get a deal, and that the Iranians want a deal, and that the Israelis are wrong in their analysis. And whether it's, wishful thinking or whistling past the graveyard or cognitive dissonance or simple, rank politicization, this is teeing up at a very critical moment to be yet another calamitous, disastrous Biden project. And I have to say, I'm really, really, really concerned about both what you've described and its accuracy, I fear, but also where this thing is likely to head next. Again, what is at foot is both alienating ourselves from friendly governments, governments that I would argue we need more than ever at the moment, as well as emboldening enemies of this country, as well as enemies of our friends, such as they are around the world. Let me ask you, David, in terms of then other things that may be on the agenda for this conversation between President Biden and Prime Minister Bennett, there is also in the works, it seems, a Biden policy towards the Palestinians that is increasingly feeding into their expectations and ambitions for statehood or for at the minimum, you know, empowerment at the expense of the Israelis. How do you see that playing out, given the very profound disagreements within Bennett's coalition in Israel and the prospect that such efforts on the part of this administration may cause that government increasing difficulty?
Well, I think any peace process will cause that government difficulty unless it's a genuine peace process. A genuine peace process means something like Sadat flying to Jerusalem or something like that. The reason why is these peace processes are really political seances. What it is, the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, is dead. It has no currency. It exists by the grace of Israeli presence around their cities. Otherwise, there would be a coup by Hamas to just wipe them out, and that would take maybe at most 15 minutes to happen. So essentially, this is a politically dead body with no currency, no traction, no influence on the Palestinian population. And we're trying to use them as the vehicle for an Israeli withdrawal, which we still believe is the only way to a peace process. So what happens is
a withdrawal from the West Bank, that would be?
Yeah, the West Bank, exactly. So the whole process reduces down to this idea that if only the Israelis would give Abu Mazen, head of the PLO, they would only give him something so substantial that it would prove his worth and the Palestinians would again fall in love with him. And then he'd have the political currency and then he can deliver the Palestinian street. That's the mentality. That's why I call it a seance. It's literally an attempt to resurrect the dead at the cost of a pound of flesh from Israel. And it will never work. So this is destined to fail. And it will cause violence again because it will trigger dynamics within Palestinian society that we've now have a historical record of 30 years will always lead to an orgy of violence that follows. But the other thing,
especially when it involves a withdrawal from areas that are then ceded to Israel's enemies.
Correct. And what it'll do is there are a few very far left parties in this coalition, and they buy into this Biden vision or the vision really of our foreign policy establishment, to be honest. They buy into this vision, and they will push it from within in the Israeli government. But then there are those in the Israeli government who are more sober. Bennett and many in his party and so forth. And we have to remember, this is a coalition that rests on one vote. So it can fall any moment if one person defects. Well, there are a number of people who live in the West Bank in this coalition. There are a number of people who can't go home and look their neighbors in the face.
And their platform has basically been to have the settlements formally annexed to Israel, has it not?
That's right. That's right. And not only in Bennett's party, but another party, the Tikva Chadasha party, it is also the Gideon Sar's party. There are some people in there like Yoaz Hendel and Zvi Hauser, which are to the right of Bibi generally. So if there's a peace process that demands a pound of flesh from Israel, and there's discussion to actually pay that pound of flesh, I cannot see how a number of these people won't bolt from the coalition, and it'll bring the government down.
And this isn't entirely hypothetical. This is an ongoing problem because it seems that the terrorists and Hamas in Gaza are once again ramping up their actions against the Israelis. There's been a rocket attack. There have been these fire balloons that lay waste to the Israeli forests or fields and agriculture and so on. I mean, these are hostile acts that are taking place as we speak.
That's absolutely correct. And now with Iran no longer having to fear the United States at its back in Afghanistan, let alone having an administration that shows any muscular attitude toward a muscular foreign policy, they know that they no longer have an American enemy. So they can now fully put all their energy into Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hamas. So you're seeing the whole Hamas front escalate. You're seeing the Lebanon front escalate. On top of it all, the Turks, who are playing for a competitive role, pick up the pieces of the ruins of the Middle East in the wake of an American collapse in the region, will find their own radicals to try to make a point, to try to compete with Iran. So what you'll have is a competitive extremism by both, which will seek blood money, will seek violence as a currency for political following, and it'll be increasingly directed at our allies like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, and certainly against Israel. But it will also be directed externally to American interests in Europe and elsewhere. So again, these attempts to try to walk away from the violence in the Middle East and appease our enemies will only embolden them, and we will actually get more violence, and it will follow us home, unfortunately.
David Wormser, thank you for this extraordinarily impressive as well as frightening forecast, and thank you for the great work that you do at the Center for Security Policy. I know you'll keep it up, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. Next up, we'll speak with the Honorable Kenneth Blackwell about, among other things, legislation now moving through the Congress to, I fear, end future free and fair elections, and what that will mean for all of us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to all of you, and most especially to our next guest. His name is the Honorable Kenneth Blackwell. He has been a distinguished public servant in quite a number of capacities, elected as the mayor of Cincinnati and as the treasurer and the secretary of state of the state of Ohio. He has also served as an ambassador for the United States at the United Nations, working on human rights issues there for a time. He is these days a senior fellow with the marvelous Family Research Council, among other things, and a very, very good friend of this program. We're always delighted to have him with us. Mr. Ambassador, welcome back. Good to talk with you.
Frank, it's so good to be with you, sir.
I always appreciate the visits because among your many incarnations, you've spent a lot of time focused on election integrity. And there was a very adverse development in the House of Representatives in that regard yesterday. It's now teeing up a major, well, hopefully debate and struggle in the United States Senate. Introduce to our audience, if you would, or reintroduce, as the case may be, H.R. 4, as it's being called. What's it about? Why is it so problematic, as you see it?
Let me set the table first, Frank, and say that the foundation of the American system of self-governance is liberty. And the core expression of the people's liberty is in the ability to vote in free and fair elections. So safeguarding the integrity of our elections is paramount to preservation of our republic. H.R. 4 is a blatant power grab. It is an attempt to federalize our elections, to impose a one-size-fits-all scheme for elections that would undermine our core principles of self-government and federalism. This destructive legislation would ban voter ID, ban cleaning up voter rolls, ban voter identity verification for absentee ballots, dictate how district lines are drawn for everything, precinct lines, school board districts, legislative, judicial, and congressional districts, every political boundary in America, and it would empower the Department of Justice and make the Attorney General the czar of elections through their advocacy of preclearance. So, look, this is dangerous. This is an existential threat to our republic, and it actually comes from the same crowd that served up defunding the police, creating an open door for a wave of crime in our local communities. The same group that is advocating for open borders, they just extended. They don't just want America to be a nation without borders. They want voters without borders.
I have considered this to be a wrecking operation, Mr. Ambassador, that is manifesting itself in the ways you've just described, to say nothing of Afghanistan, which we've been talking about with previous guests. But one thing just to clarify, I had understood that the previous iteration of this bill, this monster H.R. 1 or S.1, as it was called in the Senate, enumerated all of those horribles and said this is what, you know, will be going forward, the law of the land nationally. No voter IDs, for example, and mail-in ballots for all and all that. But that this bill was a bit more cynical and sinister, really, in that it didn't lay out all of those things as much as it simply said it's up to the Attorney General to deem what is appropriate in the various states, which will translate to the same thing, to be sure, but it was going to be a little less transparent about how really antithetical to election integrity is the intent of such legislation. Am I wrong about that, or is there something of a hybrid here?
It is a hybrid. They changed the script. They added pages to their playbook. So this is not what it once was. It is more destructive, actually more comprehensive, but more in keeping with a system that would be under one-party control forever.
And it just tees out for us, as a man who, you know, has run elections in the past, as well as, you know, served in elective office, what are the implications of having, well, to put a fine point on it, I guess, arrangements akin to, if not identical, to those that were employed in many states, certainly swing states across the country in the 2020 election, as kind of permanent law going forward?
Yeah, and just think about this, Frank. If you go back 100 years, we had the 1918 pandemic flu. We had the 1929 economic disruption. We had 1968, the waves of urban violence. And then 1974, we had the impeachment process kicked in the high gear. In 2020, we had all of those. And within that context, we saw a loosening of the chain of custody of ballots. We saw an abandonment of verification policies and practices, common sense practices and policies. And
widely popular ones at that.
Right. and we saw an expansion of the field of opportunity for irregularities and fraud. And so what has happened is that state legislatures have in fact put in place common sense reforms like voter IDs that would prohibiting private dollars to make our elections highly partisan. They in fact have been met with these false charges of a throwback to Jim Crowism and a heavy push from the left to resist those common sense practices. Those practices would make it easy to vote, but real hard to cheat. And that is in the American spirit. And I think that's why those reforms are so popular across racial and ethnic lines. People really do want to make it easy to vote, but hard to cheat. And while we put a lot on the line to make sure that access to the ballot box was there for all Americans, all legal citizens of America, in the last 15 years, we've understood that it's important to make sure that no illegal vote cancels out a legal ballot. And that is what we're doing with this reform.
When you look at this issue of voter ID, Kenneth Blackwell, you are, as the left like to say, a person of color, though I don't know that they always recognize that, so given your politics. But how do you respond to this insistence on their part that it is a denial of voting rights and access to the polls to insist that people of color, as well as others, have voter IDs?
Well, look, the left on in this matter is stuck on stupid. And what's so irritating is that they think Americans are stuck on stupid, and we're not. Photo IDs are so commonplace in American culture. You need them to pick up tickets at a will call window at a baseball game. You need them to get on an airplane. And if I want to go to Coca-Cola and talk to the CEO, before I got up to his office, I would have to show a photo ID to verify that I am who I claim to be. And so
you just mentioned Coca-Cola because it was objecting as a corporation to voter IDs, as I recall,
in
Georgia.
Delta Airlines initially, and Major League Baseball. You know, they wrapped themselves in wokeism, and until we woke them up. And that is because, just like the abolitionist Frederick Douglass and you, my friend, we understand that those who are whooped easiest are whooped most often, and we're fighters. And so this common sense reform was positioned as being a throwback to Jim Crowism. But what was so ironic, and I'll just use Major League Baseball, they moved that game from Atlanta to Denver, Colorado. When you do a side-by-side comparison of the reforms in Georgia versus the established policies in Colorado, Colorado is more restrictive. And so people understand this. And the small business owners, many of whom were black in Atlanta, really did get outraged when they saw an economic impact of $110 million go from Atlanta to Denver.
Yeah, rightly so. Ken, let me just ask you one quick question, because our audience is, as you know, particularly, I think, interested in and concerned about national security. To what degree would you say that how we elect people in this country, and whether that can be done in a manner that actually reflects the will of the voters, is a national security imperative as well as vital to the common weal more generally?
Well, Frank, look, we are free-willed citizens as a consequence of the form of government that we've experienced in this country for 245 years. We are not subjects. And if you look at the instinct, the intentions of totalitarian governments, authoritarian governments, big welfare states, it is to convert free-willed individuals to subjects. Look, as those folks who would move us into a one world government, destroy our nationalism, all you have to do to answer your question in completeness is to say that the same folks who in fact have offered those destructive policies that we've seen manifested by Joe Biden right now, that's tanking him because of the rejection of the American people, are the same folks who would move us towards a more insecure America, less of a free and powerful nation state, to being a weakling in a one world government framework.
Thank you for addressing that so directly and so articulately. Leslie, and we only have 2 minutes or so, quickly to respond if you would. The Supreme Court of the United States has just ruled by a 6-3 margin that the Biden administration must reverse course and make a quote, good faith effort, unquote, to restore the restart the policy of remain in Mexico, which Donald Trump engineered and made such a profound impact on this whole border insecurity issue. Your thoughts, sir, on the importance of that and whether it will be fulfilled?
Just tied into what we just previously said. Look, this crowd, Biden and company, wants to have us a open border a country, putting our citizens at risk in terms of human trafficking and those who would do assault on our way of life. With these waves of folks who want to find safe haven into our country, we actually need to vet them. And it was a common sense program to, you know, vet them outside of the United States. And I think the Supreme Court not only understood the correctness of the Trump policy, I think more and more Americans are saying, you know, just as these folks want to defund the police, they wanted to deconstruct that common sense practice of vetting folks outside of our country before we let them in without understanding their intention. So bravo to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. And let's be clear, as part of a broader assault on border security and immigration enforcement more broadly, and I think most especially the idea of discouraging people from coming here in the first place or trying to come here in the first place, it was a vital tool. So I very much hope that it will be followed faithfully by the Biden administration, but it's seeming to take a sometimes yes, sometimes no attitude towards Supreme Court rulings. We'll be watching it closely, as I know will you. Ambassador Kenneth Blackwell, thanks for all you do, my friend, have done for our country and are continuing to do these days at the Family Research Council. I appreciate it so much and look forward to talking with you again soon. I look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. My beloved boss Ronald Reagan repeatedly warned that, quote, every generation faces an existential threat to freedom, unquote, adding that it had to be fought for and defended and passed on to the next generation to do the same. With each passing day, it becomes clearer that we are now beset by the existential threat to liberty of our time. For example, we are being subjected to an unmitigated disaster in Afghanistan that is emboldening jihadists and other enemies and alienating our friends. The arrival of millions of illegal aliens, some of whom are ill with COVID and or other diseases, all of whom are unvetted. The institution of vaccine mandates and passports highly susceptible to Chinese-style government abuse and legislation that would foreclose future free and fair elections. Will we defend freedom or ignominiously bequeath to the next generation a formerly free America? This is Frank Affney.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.